Our teaching scripture for this morning comes from Romans chapter 8, the 18th to 27th verses. It says, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God, that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. And God, who searches the heart, knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God." This is the word of the Lord.
I imagine that my house and routine looks quite similar to other parents with young children around bedtime. There is the fetching of snacks and water, teeth brushing, snuggling, Bluey, book reading, and prayer. A few months ago, I started thinking deeply about Thomas and how Thomas and I pray with Edith, age 4. The penultimate step in our bedtime routine is prayer. Each of us takes a turn. We offer thanks for the day, ask for God's care for our friends and our neighbors, articulate to God our fears and frustrations. God, help our neighbor. She needs a job. God, thank you for your help today with my big project. Sometimes Edith likes to add jokes, and then she'll turn to us and ask, "Do you think God laughed?" I think it's great because I had never thought of telling God a joke before. I think this is all quite good, and yet I was compelled to ask some months back, is what she knows of prayer just, "You gave us this thing, thank you, and we need this other thing"? More pointedly, are we teaching our daughter that God is a giver of commodities whose favor we curry by taking time to say thank you for other stuff first? We are rooted in the daily movements of our lives. We have too much work to do, responsibilities that we have not yet attended, family members who need time and help, friends in crises, and unfulfilled longings in our own hearts. It is good to recap these things and to reflect on them, to talk as a family about them and talk to God about them, and to ask for the help that we need with them. And yet sometimes our prayers feel like evening speeches to God, the creator of the universe and all creatures large and small. And we talk about what we want and we say thanks for what God gave us. There are many ways of praying, and while it is good to stop and pause and consider how it is that I am teaching my daughter to pray and what she learns through the kinds of instruction we offer each night, as we add our amens to her prayers laced with jokes from Moana, the truth is that this kind of petitionary prayer that she is learning now is beautiful for exactly what it is and what it is right now. May we all pray with the sincerity and wonder of a 4-year-old asking for a baby sister and the opportunity to play basketball. And this kind of prayer is a gateway to the sort of intercessory prayer that I hope she learns and practices all her life. This morning, I've been asked to share on intercessory prayer and a line of the Lord's Prayer that is the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples when they asked how they should pray. This line on its own is perhaps the most difficult line for me to personally hold on to, "Thy will be done." Intercessory prayer is the act of praying on behalf of others. It involves bringing the needs and the concerns or situations of others before God in prayer, seeking God's intervention, guidance, and blessing on their lives. And praying, "Thy will be done," when we are just sitting there, holding on to hope with sadness and anticipation while we wait for the medical results, the second interview, the call from the attorney, or even just for a loved one to walk in the front door. It can feel like a brave prayer. To state the obvious, what if God's will isn't for the ending we actually want? My imagination auto-associates the phrase imaginary prayer with people wiser and more experienced than me. People who have seen things that I haven't seen. People who might even have a literal prayer closet in their house, or at least a special prayer chair. These are people who can sit and stay focused for long periods of time. Their phones are in the other room. They are holy people who keep rhythms and balance in their lives and who are truly filled with prayerful compassion upon learning of the suffering of someone's friends, uncles, brother-in-law who is in the hospital for a routine outpatient surgery. The problem with this characterization isn't that it's entirely inaccurate. It's that it's too limiting. Intercessory prayer can be and is these things. But pull back the curtain, and it is so much more. It has to be. The people in this room, our dispositions and personalities are different, our giftings and callings, what we enjoy and what we find loathsome, how we'd prefer to spend our time and what we have spent our time doing. We are from different places. We have different cultural backgrounds and different makeups on the inside. But one thing that is the same, whether we recognize it or not, is that as creaturely image bearers made in the likeness of God, we are all made to pray. And friends, no man or woman is an island. We are the body of Christ. And so we are made to pray for one another. Though it may not seem this way at all, we are inclined toward intercessory prayer. And there is an ever-present invitation for intercessory prayer in our lives. Our text this morning comes from the book of Romans, which is a real theological treatise, if you didn't catch that in the reading this morning. Located in the New Testament after the Gospels, which tell of many things, but among them the life, ministry, and miracles of Jesus. And after the book of Acts, which tells of the story of the arrival of the Holy Spirit and the extraordinary days of the church that follow, including the remarkable traveling ministry of the convert Paul, former persecutor of Jesus' followers. Here in Romans, that convert Paul weaves together argument and understanding, birthed from over 20 years of teaching and letter writing and preaching. And for this reason, the book has a kind of cohesiveness, even a clarity in its shape and tenor that sometimes, nay I say often, feels elusive in scriptural texts. Let's turn back to the text. "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us." While it is encouraging to note Paul's insistence on future glory, the part of this declaration that feels most hopeful to me is Paul's direct statement about what is so right now. There are sufferings in this present time. Real sufferings. For his own part, Paul had been physically beaten with rods 3 times, whipped 5 times, stoned, and left for dead. Imprisoned at least 3 to 5 times, shipwrecked 3 times, and for good stretches went without food, water, and shelter. He faced threats from institutional leaders who understood the gospel message of peace to be a threat to their power and economic systems as a whole. He encountered mobs and riots, all the while carrying the emotional and spiritual burden of care for young churches and new believers. He experienced conflict with and betrayal from his friends, and he lived with an apparent recurring or chronic physical ailment. Indeed, the phrase, thorn in the flesh, is from Paul. It's in 2 Corinthians. It's not a competition, but Paul knew suffering and knew about it in a way that makes me feel a little bit kinder towards some of his other writings. Paul's speech and theology comes from a place of suffering and putting his own life on the line. The present time that he experienced is not our own present time. It is not in or around 57 AD, and we are nowhere near Rome, but we have this letter. And the conditions Paul describes still rings true. Indeed, there is suffering, and creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. In hope, creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Here there's a pinging back and forth, statements of truth and scope of decay and suffering, and an eagerness for release. Release from the bondage of all things that sit on top, all things visible. My anger and anxiety are visible. The unhoused living in an encampment off the highway is visible. The state of our planet and the exploitation of its natural resources to the benefit of the rich at the expense of the poor is visible. But also, everything that runs right underneath the surface too. As a mechanic looks under the hood of a good-looking car that did not receive regular maintenance, so too do we find crippling decay and suffering in places we did not expect. Toxic work environments and less than straightforward financial statements, personal competencies that mask deep formational needs, and structural injustices that run inside and under beautiful ivy branches and flowers. We know that the whole of creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Creation groans and has been groaning about hurt, trauma, lack of opportunity, physical pain, deception, betrayal. There is something visual in the language of groaning. It's the injustice that you just feel in your bones. Sometimes we hurt so much, yes, physically, but also emotionally, that if we dare to let our mouths open or loosen our voices, a tremor of pain and grief rises from deep within us. It wells up from our bellies and escapes through our lips, raw and unfiltered, at a pitch, whether grovelly or piercing, that carries the weight of the moment. And so too do we groan in longing and anticipation of something, for life and flourishing, with ambition rooted not in vainglorious arrogance, but the pursuit of beauty and wonder. Consider the work of an artist who tends to her craft with persistence, perhaps even tenderness, bringing forth something new. Now consider also the faithful student, the business manager, entrepreneur, gardener, and parent, and their relationships and spreadsheets and risk assessments, daylilies and after-school snacks. These people also move with purpose towards something and for some reason. There is purpose and passion. There is the working out of something that is inside of them seeking expression. If you're having trouble wrapping your mind around what groaning for flourishing is and not just lament, consider the feel-good sports film, the one where the underdog leans in with all their might with 5 a.m. alarm clocks, pounding the driveway with sweat and tears in the hot summer sun, usually in a montage scene. These are things that happen because of the groaning for something good and something new. So when I say that we are all made to pray, I am calling to mind these sorts of groans, the outworking of which can take us to picket lines and cause us to oppose actions of individuals and institutions that harm the most vulnerable among us. The outworking of which can send us to work and to school and to the other side of the world, and we, like the artists, refine and chip away at that which we were called to build, and through which the great beauty and wonder of the goodness of God is revealed. Except here's the thing. As amazing as all that is, the weight of these groans, anchored in suffering, and the sheer magnitude of the groans anchored in flourishing, it can plumb take you out. The weight of the world hangs in these groans, and so what do we do with them? One thing we often do is dull and distract, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but also milder things, less intense, more socially acceptable. I go very hard during the day, playing my part to get my household running in the morning. Mental and sometimes emotional crunches and pull-ups and push-ups all day as part of my 8 to 5. Right into evening pickup and dinner preparation. And on weeknights, I prepare dinner because I like cooking, but mostly because I don't want to do the dishes. Come 7:30, 8, 8:15, 9, who knows, whatever time it is that Edith was put to bed and is settled in and no longer needs parental attention, I crash hard. There are relaxing activities that I enjoy. Reading for fun, writing for fun, baking, repurposing leftovers, even cleaning. I get satisfaction from bubbly cleaning products and a sparkling bathroom. But these are not things that I can do at the end of a typical day. My nerves, my brain, my muscles are all bunched up from the activity of the day. And I find myself at the single lowest energy moment that I will be in at any point in my waking hours. And so often, I curl up in my comfy bed with my fluffy warm blanket. I wrap myself in pillows, leg, side, head, side, leg. I eat something small with a little bit of chocolate, and I doom scroll to my heart's content. I watch a video of some suburban woman decant her dried goods and vegetables in a sparkly clean refrigerator and pantry, which is strangely soothing. With some comfort show on a bigger screen in the background, you know you've done this. Something like The West Wing or Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Except here's the thing. Though I am entirely knocked out at this time of day, getting comfy and doomstrolling while a winsome and somewhat heroic plot plays out in front of me with like 10% of my attention, that does not always bring contentment to my heart. In fact, sometimes it agitates it. Rest and care for oneself is a good thing. I'm not actually saying a word against any component part of my ultimate crash behaviors, nor am I saying that they cannot be done well altogether. Rather, I'm saying that my repeated practice of them in the context in which I was practicing them, at the end of very intense days with no built-in space for real reflection, constituted burying my head in the sand and coping with the stress and pain of my life and the lives of the people around me by dulling my sense of them through distraction. It's what I did with my own groans and the ones I could feel and see around me that were too intense. And so in recognizing this, I stumbled across a practice some while ago where I simply shut the screens off in the evening. No doom scrolling, no shows after Edith goes to bed. Instead, I just sit on my porch, or stand on my porch, or lay in my bathtub in silence. And wow. The moment I do that, two things happen. I will either fall asleep, or my awareness of my own groaning and that of the world around me shoots up like 700 billion percent, almost instantly. It's what comes right after that awkward boredom and fumbling as you realize that there's literally nothing left in your hands to distract you. Left with real groans, we sit at the crucible of prayer, a place where distraction is stripped away and we are confronted with the rawness of our need, our longing, and our helplessness. In that silence where there is no buffer between us and the weight of the world, we discover both the depth of our pain, the pain we can see, and the profound invitation to bring it before God. It is not always comfortable, but it is in that unguarded space that a certain kind of prayer begins. Prayer that isn't about words, but about presence. Prayer that isn't polished, but is honest. And prayer that rises from the groans that we've tried to suppress, drawing us into communion with the one who hears, who understands, and who groans with us, and for all that we carry. The passage continues, "For in hope we are saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words." Hope is a big word, often bound up in truisms like the exhortations of the aged, faded poster in my middle school locker room calling us seventh grade girls to reach for the stars. But the truth is that hope is more like an embroidery piece, tended to night after night by a skilled hand working under a light, pulling stitch by stitch. As days stretch to weeks, stretch to months, the artist might stitch the word hope into the fabric and hold to that word's meaning once it hangs on her wall. But hope itself, the act of hope, that's really found in the making of the piece. It's practiced there as the artist engages the slow, hard work of opening herself up directly and unmuted before God, in vulnerability with the full power of all that's groaning inside. This act is not just a psychological exercise wherein an artist's angst gets out in a piece of handiwork, or even a matter of calmness achieved through meditation. Our hope is for a future glory despite a present experience of suffering and death, and in our hope we join God in pulling that glory right into the present. This is what intercession does. It is a meaningful act of contest for God's good and peaceful kingdom in the world. We hope for what we do not see, and in that act of hoping, we wait for it with patience. This is not the kind of patience of a dog trained to sit at the appearance of a treat. It's something like the patience of Simeon, the righteous and devout man in Jerusalem, whose story is recounted in Luke chapter 2. The Spirit had revealed to Simeon that he would not die without seeing the coming Messiah, and so he waited. And indeed, Simeon met the baby Jesus in the temple some 40 days after his birth. Hoping is what we do while we wait, and it is the Spirit that helps us in our weakness. From the place of vulnerability with our groans and our hope, we are helped by the Spirit. Friends, God did not put all that good stuff inside of you that leads you to true compassion and to care about the needs and concerns and situations of others to leave you out there on a limb. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we did not know how to pray, but that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. There are a lot of ways that we can intercede. Some people make a list, a prayer list, as simple as that. These written words can act as a guide, maybe especially when the weakness manifesting is forgetfulness. When I was in the sixth grade, I was in some kind of Christian club at my middle school. And I'll be honest, it's the kind of club that in retrospect, I'm not really sure that it was always on the nose about the kinds of things that actually mattered. I remember very little But what I do remember the faculty instructor saying to us 6th, 7th, and 8th graders strikes me as the kind of thing I couldn't imagine saying to a middle school child. It wasn't anything bad, just stuff that was really laced with like a kind of fundamentalist fervor that I don't know was altogether necessary, except for this one thing. I think it was at our Christmas party. We were instructed to make a list with 3 things we could pray for. One of the items on my list, honest to goodness, was for the salvation of a global geopolitical figure who had perpetrated a lot of violence in the world. Another item on the list was my own grandfather, a loving, kind man without any space or structure or place for God in his life. My whole life, I had heard my dad talk about praying for my grandfather, and in that season, as a 12-year-old, I joined my dad, and I don't remember what the 3rd thing was. But I do know this. I prayed that list. And while I actually believe that the act of coming to faith in Jesus can look so many different ways, conventional and non-conventional, evangelical conventional is one of them. And in those, I don't know, a couple months, I went out on a walk with my grandpa to the park so I could practice my pitching. And along the way, I asked him questions about church. And he told me about how the last Sunday there had been an invitation to follow Jesus. And the pianist played that old hymn, Trust and Obey. And he felt the Spirit invite him to trust and obey, but it was like he was glued to his seat. And he couldn't get up. And he was sad that he didn't respond. And he said he figured he better get up next Sunday. And I said, Grandpa, you can follow Jesus now. And we prayed together in the park. I didn't have the same conversation with a global geopolitical figure that had perpetrated a lot of violence. But he did. He did die while I was praying for him. And I wondered, with the compassion and tenderness of a 12-year-old's heart, about the condition of that villain's heart at his time of death. And while I did not give thanks for death, I held thanks in my heart that he was no longer hurting anyone. And I'll be honest, I've wondered about the real power of intercessory prayer, because there are so many things in this world that don't make sense. But in that couple of months that I prayed about those 2 things, praying for my grandpa after years and years and years of people praying for him, and praying for this true villain, whom I'm sure lots of people around the world were having conversations with God about. Something big and visible related to his life and the history of violence happened during my set time of prayer. As I've learned more about intercessory prayer, and as I've practiced it more, and certainly with the help of the Spirit in my weakness, I've learned a few more ways to do it. There was a particular moment in my early adulthood when some really grievous things were suddenly moving in a couple of specific places in the world. And the result was the sudden and extreme vulnerability of a large number of refugees. And it hurt my heart. I can remember nearly physically groaning out loud in the grocery store one weekend. I held onto my cart so that I wouldn't fall over, and certainly tears welled up in my eyes. In that moment, I did not pray with words. Instead, prayer was like a heartbeat. It just sat on top of my chest. It's the sort of prayer that you might not even know to call a prayer, except, of course, that's what it is. It wasn't just that I was sad. My spirit was bound up with the work of the Spirit, who helps us in our weakness and intercedes with sighs too deep for words. Around that same time, I made a friend at church with some similar groans, and she invited me to her busy and chaotic home with young children running around. And her sister came over, and there were three of us groaning together, the way I prayed at the grocery store, except this time, at least part of the time, we had real words. And I remember quite distinctly, as we were praying for the refugees, one of the women that I was with started praying, "Lord, where there is one jug of water, make it two. Refill the bag of rice. Refill it, Lord." And then pulling back just a minute and offering some kind of commentary to those of us in the room, she said, "I don't know why I never thought of that before. When I prayed, yes, God, help the refugees as they escaped on foot and at sea. Give them a place to go, a home, care, safety. But as much as they need all those things, they need food and water right now. They need food and water specifically right now. So let's pray with specificity, with sighs too deep for words, in our weakness, with the help of the Spirit. In this side of heaven, we'll never know what food might be showing up. But let's do it anyways. And God, who searches the heart, knows what the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. God searches the heart. I think that's why intercessory prayer can feel like prayer sitting on top of my heartbeat. God, who searches the heart, knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. I said at the top of the sermon that the prayer that goes with this week's lesson is, "Thy will be done." I don't know what kind of God's will you grew up with or were exposed to as a child, what you might have bumped into in your adolescence, and how that may or may not have fit into big decisions, big parts of your life, work, vocation, family. But it can start getting messy once we start taking God's will, because there's stuff talking God's will. Because there is suffering and heartbreak in this present time. I believe that there is no person or circumstance that is not redeemable. There is no illness, no crisis, no conflict, and no loss untouchable to our God, who in Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and buried, descended to the dead, and then rose on the third day again. That is true. And still, the full redeeming work of God's good kingdom is not done. And so we can pray for the multiplication of food, and it can multiply. But until such time as all is set right, people will still go hungry. I hate that. But let's get real about where God's will is in all of that. As it stands in the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven." God's will is bound up in the goodness of God's kingdom. And in the prayer, "Thy will be done," we pray like an activation for earth to become like heaven. Therefore, God's will is not in like a weird, mysterious thing that we have to guess about. I mean, sure, there's moments, lots of moments, when we got to stop and discern the way forward or how to respond to something. It requires good and proper discernment. What is God inviting us into? And certainly, we are presented with the task and opportunity to pause and notice and respond to where God is present in lives in the world. And those things will blow by us if we don't pay attention. But in this, we're not guessing if God's will is on the side of life and justice. We never need to guess if God is with and for the poor and the sick and the suffering. Indeed, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And here, right in the middle of Paul's treatise, God who searches the heart knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. Friends, we intercede and the Spirit joins us. The Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. As we intercede, we can pray, thy will be done, because it is a desperate and big and safe prayer that we do not pray alone. In our weakness, we can pray, thy will be done, as we hold with tenderness fragile and vulnerable groans in our own bodies, as we grow in care and respond to the world around us. Thy will be done is a big enough prayer for it all. Now let's get down to brass tacks about how to do this. You can hold a moment of silence, or 5 minutes, to think about and hold on to real needs and pains, opportunities even, that you see around you for your neighbor, near or far. For example, you can remind yourself or imagine what it must feel like for your brother who just got a new job and has a really long commute. And you can hold on to that. And you can pray words for your brother if you got them. Maybe words like, God, it's so exhausting to sit in traffic, especially when your mind and body need rest after so much newness in one day. Get him home quick, Lord. Get him home quick tonight. And if you don't have words, that's cool too. Maybe focus in on some emotion or emotions that you think your brother might be experiencing as he starts his new job with a long commute. And hold that like a pin over your heart. And just feel it. And pray, thy will be done, Lord. Thy will be done. You can intercede for someone close to you, like a family member, someone you love deeply but don't get to see all the time, like a brother or an old friend. And you can intercede for people in situations you're not anywhere near. Sometimes the people in situations that aren't near us are harder to tap into, but there's good and needed prayer there. And the Spirit will help you in your weakness. A good way to settle into intercessory prayer for something or someone that's not right around us is indeed just to settle in. Until recently, I was the board chair at Sanctuary Night, a drop-in center for vulnerable women over on Sullivan Avenue. And there's a lot to pray about there. And the truth is, as board chair, I was not that, you know, far removed from the organization. I was institutionally deeply tied to it. But I was not in the building that much. And that's where the real magic happens, where struggling and suffering and hope and redemption play out on a daily basis. I would pray as I did my board work, and you better believe that I asked for help and pounded out the floor of my attic as I paced and prayed. But it was something different when I settled into interceding for Sanctuary Night's day-to-day work. I'd reflect on a conversation I had with Hannah, the executive director, or more likely than not, the narrative in her director's report to the board, and it would pluck at the part of my heart that groans. I could skip over it, the part of my soul that groans, and sometimes I did. But if I stopped and I held on to that grief and longing and hope for the activity that moves through that building on a daily basis, it was too much. The very Spirit that intercedes with sighs too deep for words. Thy will be done, Lord. Thy will be done. I'd like to invite you to pray, thy will be done, as you practice intercessory prayer. The place that you are at right now, seemingly near to God, far from God, deconstructing, reconstructing, Your prayers count in all the places. And they don't gotta be anything fancy. It's just a moment of real connection and expression between you and God about someone or some situation that connects to the groaning in your own soul and the goodness and peace of God's kingdom. And I got good news. That real connection part, that's not on you, that's on God. So just express what you got. And if the idea of something connected to the groaning of your soul feels too big, then okay, that's fine. Start by praying for someone that you have just a little bit of empathy for. Your coworker who's not getting sleep because of their kids, your friend with a micromanaging boss, a kid you know who's struggling with some friendships. In intercessory prayer, pray words if you got them. And if you don't, simply direct your thoughts and emotions toward the person or situation you want to pray for and hold them like a pin over your heart. And just take the words from the prayer that Jesus taught us, "Thy will be done." We're coming up here on the end, but we're not going to end this sermon without taking a minute or two for a little intercessory prayer. So you can just settle in. We're just going to pray by ourselves. So I invite you to take a minute or two. Then we're going to come back. We'll have prayer ministry. We'll do the musical worship things. But first, let us pray silently and individually and all together.